Hello and welcome to another episode of the Leaders Sport Business Podcast, the podcast about leaders in sport from Leaders in Sport. My name is James Emmett. I'm the editorial director here at Leaders, and with me, as ever, or again, is David Cushnan, my great good colleague and content director here at Leaders. David, how are you?
I am well, James. Nice to see you. It's been a while.
Do you know what? It feels like it has been a while. We've done some individual podcasts recently, or we've had different partners. We've been do-si-do-ing, haven't
we? We simply haven't been available at the same time for a number of weeks.
3 weeks, I believe. I enjoyed your effort from a couple of weeks ago where you had Ahmed Nasser on. That was a very interesting podcast.
Thank you very much. Would you like me to say something complimentary about the one you did?
No, that's fine.
Thank you. No, I did enjoy it.
I can't even remember it. It was too long ago.
No, to confirm, I did enjoy it.
What's going on, David? What's new with you? I see you've got quite a severe new haircut for our listeners who aren't viewing any of this visually. What I would do is maybe advise you to check out the YouTube interview that we did last week. Leaders in Focus with Anna-Marie Phelps, the vice chair of the BOA. I think that was done just minutes after David had this haircut.
I don't actually believe in real life, and I've actually taken it upon myself to check with several people. I don't think it's that drastic a haircut, IRL. Unfortunately, due to a combination of, I believe, you know, camera angles and lighting, it does look extraordinary in the Leaders in Focus video. Just another reason, though, to go and give it a watch over on YouTube.
Yet another. It was actually a very good interview with Anna-Marie Phelps, a serial sporting chair, current vice chair of the BOA, chairman of all sorts of different sports organisations across Europe and the world. A very busy woman as we count down to Paris 2024 especially.
And I thought lots of top tips in there around key skills required to be a good board member, to be a great chair, to be really effective in those roles, and particularly liked the bit where she talked about the dynamic between a chair and a CEO and what that should look like in its best form. Lots of good stuff in there, lots of advice for younger people in the industry looking to make their way, and some really interesting stuff on, as you say, the you know, some of the big issues in sport at the moment: government regulation, government perhaps interference in sport, and also, obviously, as we all look ahead to the summer, the Olympics world, and how that's looking health-wise at the moment.
Do you know what? I think one of the key skills required of great chair people, probably in all walks of life, not just in sport, but maybe especially in sport, is diplomacy. And I thought Anna-Marie was brilliant. Not in the interview itself necessarily, but before the interview, I was really trying to tease out whether she had won or lost at Cheltenham the previous week, because she's a former chair of the British Horse Racing Association, and she was a guest in the Royal Box, no less, on the Friday Gold Cup day of Cheltenham a couple of weeks ago, and she just wouldn't be drawn on whether she was up or down on the day.
Does that suggest a big loss?
I just think that shows a deftness to be able to, you know, just bob and weave around direct questions.
Well, is it a deafness that you also possess? James, you went to Cheltenham, I believe, on the first day, the Tuesday?
Yes.
Up or down?
Up.
Okay.
Good.
Good, and not ashamed to admit it.
Not ashamed to admit that I'd done my research, and I did walk away £11 richer than I arrived. So fabulous. Fabulous effort there.
It's interesting. We're in this period of the year. I really like this time of year.
There is a weekend, actually, in April, which is, in my view, the most extraordinary weekend of sport.
Would it be Masters
it's
weekend?
It's Masters weekend, which always coincides with a particular Grand Prix. I can't remember which one it is.
It's maybe China this year.
Or maybe it's not.
No,
maybe
they've slightly rejigged the calendar this year, but there will be a Grand Prix.
Yeah, there's
always a Grand Prix.
There's an incredible cycling race. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the classics. I think it might be the Tour of Flanders.
Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
No. No, I think it might be the Tour of Flanders. It's usually FA Cup semi-final weekend.
Yes.
Here in the UK.
Could there be the London Marathon?
And it, no, they wouldn't do that, would they?
I don't know.
They wouldn't. You wouldn't program two BBC stalwart things in the masters.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I actually.
What were you going to say?
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was it's a great time of year, and there's loads happening at the moment. Sort of big sports events, but events that, you know, and this is our world, have a lot of business wrapped around them. We're in the opening exchanges in the Indian Premier League, which I will say, having, we made the trip out to Bangalore last year for the for our event there with Royal Challengers Bangalore, and it has prompted me to keep a little bit more of an eye on the IPL than perhaps I ordinarily would. Mm. And also, we're in the thick of March Madness for our US listeners, of course, won't need us to tell you about that. And March Madness is one of those events that doesn't really make an impact at all in the UK, other than sort of in passing social the odd social media clip, if you're following the right people. But in the US, clearly it is one of the staples of the sporting calendar, in much the same way, I think, that the Cheltenham Festival has over probably, what, the last decade or so, really become not just one of the big events of the sporting year, but one of the big sports industry gatherings, I think. And it's become a real, hospitality is a key element of it. And once again, this year, the great and the good of the industry were in Cheltenham. Not the best weather.
Mixed, it's sort of the dying embers of winter, isn't it? So it's often a bit mizzly and a bit grey. In mid-March in the West Country.
And there have been a few headlines and a few sort of indicators, I suppose, that perhaps the Cheltenham Festival is not necessarily struggling a little, but perhaps has peaked as an event.
Yeah.
And some of the key numbers are down, certainly on what they were pre-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You were there, you were on the ground, you're a regular. You're a racing fan.
Mm-hmm.
You're a tremendous better.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that successful better,
yeah,
as you just said.
Sure.
How did you find it this year?
Well, it's interesting. I always think Cheltenham is a... it's sort of a standard, but it's a bellwether, really, for sports and entertainment in the UK, at least. Partly because of where it falls in the calendar. It's probably the first large, major gathering in the sports and entertainment kind of universe every calendar year. Partly because of the demographics of the audience that it attracts. So although it is quite male, it does attract a range of different socioeconomic demographics. So horse racing has all sorts of a very complicated stakeholder environment, but also that complicated and various stakeholder environment is reflected in the type of audiences it attracts. So it's got a lot of bases covered in that regard. And probably over the last decade, probably even two, it has been, if not at the forefront, then very much in the centre of trends that we're seeing in the sports and entertainment events space. So this sort of festivalisation of mm-hmm. events, it is called the Cheltenham Festival, quite literally. But in terms of adding non-core activity into the programme, Cheltenham's been very much on the case with that. So adding music, non-racing, non-sporting kind of entertainment to attract the more diverse crowd, to keep them at the venue and to keep them spending on lots of different things. That's the MO of a lot of sports events, rights holders and venues at the moment. Cheltenham and the Jockey Club, which owns Cheltenham, have very much been on the case with that for some time. So it's a bit of a bellwether for how the industry is going to do, how sports and entertainment events are going to do across the year, and in general how they're doing in a period of time. And as you say, numbers down, and in some cases quite worryingly so. So Cheltenham runs for 4 days. It's run for 4 days over the last 10 years or so. It attracts almost 250,000 people across those 4 days. this year, 11,000 down on last year. And one of the days, the Wednesday, was very significantly down. So I think there was a high watermark a couple of years ago of 67,000. I've got the figure actually, 64,000 in 2022. It was at 47,000 through the gates on the Wednesday this year. A variety of reasons for that. And if you look in the racing media, there'll be talk of uncompetitive fields, of the difficulty in putting on particular races, of low prize money, of kind of Irish domination of the sport. That's all well and good. Those may well be issues, and I'm sure they are for real racing fans. But to be honest, for casual fans and big eventers, which absolutely is why Cheltenham is a bellwether event, is because it attracts big eventers. I'm not sure any of that stuff cuts through. It's cost of living. It's the expense of being at that venue and of spending money on drinks and food and everything else that comes with it. It's the difficulty in getting there. It is not a city centre location. It's out in the sticks in the West Country. It's very difficult to get to the station and then get out to the venue. There's all manner of things going on, and really money is at the core of it.
Key for any rights holder, any event organizer, as we all know, is renewing the audience, continually renewing the people coming through your gates, sort of year on year, decade on decade, and it's an ongoing process. And you mentioned the lack of diversity in the crowd in some respects.
Yeah.
And there is definitely I think it's fair to say, a bit of a drinking culture and a drinking perception around Cheltenham. I wonder.
Yeah, although Guinness 0.0, the alcohol-free Guinness, is plastered absolutely everywhere in terms of sponsorship advertising around Cheltenham. And it's a great drink, David. I don't mind saying.
Sure. But even the way that Cheltenham is talked about in the media, it's often equated with, you know, drinking and, you know, a big party. And that is how, to a large extent, it's been sold, certainly to those more sort of casual fans. And I wonder whether that is actually worth a bit of a rethink now. And it's not an apples for apples comparison, but it did make me think a little bit of what we saw in Phoenix a few weeks ago, the Waste Management Open, the PGA Tour event, which for years has marketed itself as, you know, completely distinct from any other PGA Tour event. It's a party. There's a lot of noise where in other venues, at other tournaments, there would be silence as players, you know, hit shots. And they've got this party hole. And I think many people will remember the clips and the footage from this year where it got all sorts of out of control. And they ended up having to effectively close the course at a certain point. And there is a complete rethink going on in terms of how that event is staged and presumably how it's marketed and positioned.
Yeah.
As a concept. And I wonder whether, to a less extreme extent, whether there's got to be a little bit of thinking to be done by the organisers at the Cheltenham Festival about how they bring through a new audience as they add all these, you know, non-core racing activities, entertainment elements to, you know, what is a tremendous sporting spectacle. Maybe that's one thing that is going to be on the agenda for discussion.
Yeah, almost certainly. And it's worth saying that the Jockey Club, which operates Cheltenham, has a relatively new leadership team, senior leadership team. You know, there's been quite a lot of change at senior executive level at the Jockey Club. Nevin Truesdale has been chief executive for a couple of years now. Anna Chanduvi, formerly of Meta, is there as CCO. You've got Stu Williamson there running communications. And I know that there is a concerted effort to view racing, people who are interested in racing, through the lens of communities, sort of different communities that are interested in different activities, different experiences. And I think we're going to see some significant change coming down the line. It was interesting. One of our colleagues here is not interested in sport, has just been on holiday to Tenerife. And she was saying that whole swathes of the town. So she went during Cheltenham Festival and the lead up to St. Patrick's Day. She's saying whole swathes of the town in Tenerife were just taken over by horse racing fans who'd taken over all the bars and were just using them to kind of watch racing and bet, because it was cheaper to go on holiday to Tenerife for a week and to watch horse racing from out there and bet on it than it was to go to Cheltenham.
And it's not unique. And you mentioned the access, you know, it's a difficult place to get to because it's in, you know, effectively in the countryside ish certainly compared to a lot of sports events where the general trend is to move them as much as possible towards city centres and where people live. And there's a lot of parallels to for example the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, which is in a similarly rural location. And yeah, that does in a lot of ways add to the cost when you're already paying for, you know, expensive tickets or tickets that have become more expensive. So, yeah, a lot of challenges, but
a great day out, I must say. Yeah. What a great day out. But also, the serious point, there has been change coming up to this point at Cheltenham and across horse racing, I think. And again, this thing of it being a bellwether for the industry. Venues are switching how they're formatted to attract more hospitality guests. There are more hospitality locations at sporting venues like this. And I'm not sure on the total kind of revenue yield for Cheltenham. 11,000 people down on last year. Who knows about the actual money? But I wonder what the consequences of those shifts that are happening across the industry. Let's take away some general admission space and give it to these more sort of premium economy, premium hospitality.
Higher yield seats, effectively.
Higher yield seats, yeah. That is changing the types of people and the atmosphere at sporting events.
Indeed. What should we do next, James? We've got plenty to get through today. It's worth saying it's just us today. We don't actually have a guest with us, so we're going to take a bit of a wander through some of the industry stories of the moment. Shall we do a little bit of news right now?
Yeah, should we do a little bit of news, Dave? I think that is a good idea. We're back together, so you turn that way and I'm going to turn this way, and together we've got the full 360 covered. This is 180 seconds of Sports Biz.
And as we record this during the European lunch hour on Tuesday, the 26th of March, the NFL owners are arriving for day three of their annual meeting. Already, the owners have agreed on an expansion of the league's international team marketing programme. Four clubs are new to the global programme: the Browns, the Colts, the Lions and the Giants, with the latter three all taking Germany as a country of focus. The Browns have been allocated Nigeria. On the agenda today, a vote on the Hard Knocks documentary series and a proposed new sponsorship agreement, which will see Sony and Verizon share branding space on coaches' headsets.
Private equity firm Bright Path Sports Partners have bought a 40% stake in second-tier English football club Ipswich Town. The firm, which deploys Native American capital into sports and entertainment projects around the world, is reported to have paid around £105 million to do so. The new investors will work alongside majority shareholders ORG, which have reduced their stake from 90% to 50% as the club battles to return to the Premier League.
Bahrain's Mumtakalat Sovereign Wealth Fund has completed its full buyout of the McLaren Group, which comprises its F1 team, other motorsport interests and its automotive division. Mumtakalat has been an investor in McLaren since 2007. In parallel with that news, McLaren CEO Zak Brown has extended his contract to 2030.
As the IPL starts its 2024 season with another record set of streaming numbers, the Wasserman Agency has announced it has launched a new cricket division. 111 million viewers logged onto the Geo Cinema platform to stream coverage of the opening game of this season between the Royal Challengers Bangalore and the Chennai Super Kings. Meanwhile, as Wasserman continues its overall rebrand of its newly acquired CSM Sports and Entertainment Agency, it has now launched a cricket division. Wasserman Cricket is the new name of Phoenix Management Group, which CSM acquired in 2022. Key clients include Ben Stokes and Joe Root.
The German Football Federation has signed a deal with Nike that will see the US sportswear manufacturer pay a reported 100 million euros a year for the right to put the swoosh on the German national team kits. The deal will kick in from 2027 and run until 2034. Current and historic German kit manufacturer Adidas is currently paying a reported 50 million euros a year.
Malaysia Airlines is the new global airline partner of Manchester United, filling a category that has been vacant at the club since it cut ties with Russian carrier Aeroflot in 2022. Malaysia Airlines joins the likes of Emirates at Arsenal, Etihad at Manchester City, Saudia at Newcastle United as airlines with significant Premier League sponsorships. Liverpool, which previously had a deal with Malaysia Airlines, and Chelsea currently do not have airline partners after the latter's agreement with Oman Air, announced last year, collapsed.
And that was 180 seconds of SportsBiz.
Force is your two-day event experience exploring the intersection between the worlds of sport, entertainment, lifestyle, and pop culture. It's your space to unlock the potential in collaboration. The event, taking place this May in New York, is just around the corner on the 21st and 22nd of May. Join 600 industry peers to generate fresh ideas from outside your lane. And keep up to date at www.4-se.com.
The Oman Air deal, David.
Yes.
Collapsed or terminated quietly by mutual agreement?
Bit of both.
Bit of both.
Bit of both. But yeah, it's a strange one because announced with much fanfare last year ended almost before it had really begun. Yeah. But I'm slightly fascinated by airlines and what they sponsor and when they choose to sponsor it. It's often historically connected to the launch of new routes into certain cities. So you tend to get some unusual ones. But I think in the Manchester United case, Malaysia Airlines with a global marketing push there, and probably no better team to be associated with if you want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Airlines, I always like an official wine. I think that can be quite entertaining as well. What are the good categories?
It's watches. I think watches are good. Luxury watches. More on our favourite categories. If you've got a favourite sponsorship category, do drop us a line.
What about this NFL owners meeting then? They're in Orlando this week, are they?
Yeah, the big annual meeting in Orlando. It's a chance for the owners to get together, make some decisions. You would imagine that a lot of what is on the agenda has probably already been decided and just needs a little bit of signing off. I imagine there's a lot of prep work that goes into these kind of gatherings, these kind of meetings. But yeah, a couple of interesting bits and pieces there. And the sort of continuing expansion of the NFL's international marketing program. Lots of teams now with lots of different markets, many of them with multiple markets that they have rights to go into and promote the promote what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think we've talked about it before, must be gathering a lot of data. I'm assuming that the teams share or are forced to share what they're finding, what they're learning in those markets.
Do you think?
I would imagine so. With the league. I would imagine so. And that must be it's a really smart way for the NFL to gather a lot of on-the-ground knowledge of fans, how fans behave, what fans think about the NFL, because there's a lot to consider there. A lot of different ways in which people in different parts of the world consume a league like the NFL. There'll be clear traits around different time zones and sort of what time in the day the games are being beamed in. So, always interesting to see who is doing what and who are the internationally focused NFL teams and who's got an eye on the global market.
I think it's interesting that they've been doing it for a year or so now. I think it's interesting that they're doing it in the first place because, it's been established for some time that the NFL... internationally, the NFL itself has fans. You are a fan of the league. You might be a fan of several teams, several players. It doesn't matter to you. The sort of team allegiance thing doesn't matter in the same way as it might if you were a domestic NFL fan. And actually, I was chatting to Alex Willis from the Premier League the other day, who was saying that they've done a bit of research at the Premier League, which has shown that this is indeed the case for the Premier League around the world as well. In the same way as you can be an NFL fan outside of America, you can be a Premier League fan outside of the UK. And they're sort of designing lots of different personas, I guess, as sort of ways to identify how people come into the Premier League ecosystem. And one is you might be a fan of an individual player or individual players. One is you might be a fan of a team. One is, and this is by far the largest one, you're just a fan of the Premier League brand, Premier League football. And then, you know, your digital offering, the offering that you're going to get from the league changes and is different to suit those personas. The NFL, further ahead of the Premier League in terms of how it's doing, well, the Premier League obviously monetizes media rights in a way that far outstrips the NFL internationally. But the NFL, I think, may be a little bit further ahead in terms of central thinking when it comes to internationalization. And it is interesting that they're pushing this team route.
Further ahead, but probably with more explanation to do in a lot of these markets, just because of the global nature of soccer versus
football. Well, they've had an organised approach to it for some time because of the natural advantage that the Premier League has.
And actually, just to dot the I's and cross the T's on how expanded this has become since 2022 when it launched.
Yes.
25 clubs now participating in the programme across 19 different international markets. I think a couple of the really interesting ones here, New York Jets have taken Ireland, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you've got the Cleveland Browns taking Nigeria, which is obviously, as we know, a market with a huge population.
Yeah.
And actually a market that's tremendously interested in Premier League football as well. So a lot going on there. And from the NFL's point of view, simply by dint of the number of games per season, it's not going to be possible to have a continuing expansion of the number of games it plays internationally. They're not going to be able to play games in every market that they might wish to. So they've got to be looking, I think, at other ways and sort of, as you say, using the teams to tap into these markets is probably an interesting and smart way to look at it.
Yeah, a few other bits and pieces from that meeting. The LA Rams are getting the Pacific Rim. They're adding a few more territories to the ones that they already have. And the Miami Dolphins now have 6 international regions that they are looking to market to, which is a lot. Jed York is stepping up his ownership stake in the San Francisco 49ers, or he's doing a sort of internal family bank transfer, maybe getting shares off his mother to become the individual majority owner there. And there will be no decision this time, at least, on this proposal to accept private equity investment into franchises.
Yeah, minority stakes in franchises.
Stakes,
we're already seeing it in the NBA, but not quite yet in the NFL, although there is definitely a process for that to potentially happen.
These meetings, I do think, of anything, of any sort of private gathering in the sports industry, these are the things that I think I'd like to be a fly on the wall of most. Just an extraordinary gathering of individuals, and especially now at this time where you've got, it's always a bit strange in the US, but you basically have old money and new money. Mm-hmm. Right? You've got old traditional owners who've had their franchises in the family for some time. You know, the likes of the Yorks at the San Francisco 49ers, and then you've got this wave of new private equity or tech money that's coming in, and the clash of ideologies and mindsets that must be inherent there must be fascinating. I also wonder about what snacks they have, how often they sort of break, who speaks loudest in the room, whether they wheel people in to come and give sort of interesting presentations.
Well, also the power dynamics between Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner.
Yes.
The boss.
Who's in front of all of his employers, by the way.
But yet he's not necessarily the boss here. So it's, you know, yes, I agree. It would be fascinating to Even just to be in there for a few minutes to get a feel for it.
Just let me in for a few minutes, please. The sports media and, just sports consumer internet got its knickers in a collective twist this week, David, with the news that Nike is going to be the new kit manufacturer of the German football national teams from 2027. It is, objectively, if you take away the whole Nike versus Adidas thing, it's a massive deal. It's a minimum of, you know, 700 million euros reported as, 100 million euros a year over 7 years. Germany is one of the largest international football teams, one of the largest kind of domestic markets. That's very large. Do we care much beyond, you know, everyone seems to be sort of frothing at the mouth about Adidas. How can it be kicked off its home team by Nike?
I think there's always a little bit of a fascination beyond the core sports industry when it comes to Nike in particular.
Yeah.
And Nike versus Adidas.
Yeah.
I was a bit surprised that this one went as mainstream as it did. You know, I hear everything that you were saying about, you know, accurately about the sort of historic nature of the relationship between Adidas and the German team. And I suppose it's one of those deals that you never really think about and you sort of just assume is going to go on and on and on and get renewed. Clearly, the German FA have opted for a better offer. Mm. And again, I'm sure these things are kind of happening and there's sort of competition for these kind of rights, you know, often that we don't hear about at all. And Nike and Adidas will be well used to going into battle with each other for big contracts. It's also worth saying that it's not been a particularly successful few years for the German national team. So actually to get a deal like this, significant uplift, is probably one that they're going to take. It only kicks in 2027, sees them through until at least 2034.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's somewhat interesting, but yeah, a bit surprised at how mainstream it went as a story, actually.
Mm, mm.
Funny what breaks through, isn't it?
Isn't it just, yeah. Although I do think there is a growing market for news about sportswear organisations. And I think this is a place where kind of fashion, sport, and business cross over for new audiences, basically. And maybe it's a tortured segue into what we're going to do in New York. But I've been listening to some podcasts, David, about mm-hmm. about sportswear manufacturers. There's an interesting BBC series called Sneakonomics, which was recorded or was at least came out in 2021, I think, which is. It's the history of this battle between Adidas and Puma, and then the introduction of Nike later on. I think there's a market well beyond people who are interested in business in what Nike and Adidas does and what they produce. Which is playing out across lots of different areas of the sports industry, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, interesting. I think probably is something in that. I think you talked about what we're planning in New York, and there's definitely going to be an element, I think, of all of that in what we're planning. We're talking about Force New York, of course, which is our sport meets entertainment meets lifestyle meets culture extravaganza, a business conference, hopefully with a little bit of a twist. Let's do the dates first. That's probably the most important thing. 21st and 22nd of May. It's the same week as the Sport Business Awards from our colleagues at SBJ. So a big sports industry week in Manhattan. And yes, as we're assembling the programme, we've been doing a lot of collective thinking about, in particular, as you say, that relationship between sport and fashion, what it looks like at the moment, what it could look like, how value can be generated out of collaborations or more formal partnerships, and the way in which that all has increasing, when it's done right, can have increasing cultural currency and cultural impact.
That's right, yeah. So it's a sports, media, brands and popular culture show. And as you say, David, we are focused on the sort of the intersection between all of those four things where commercialization is happening. Like, how are organizations in sports and entertainment taking advantage of the cultural impact that they're having for commercial growth? And I think there are some fascinating case studies that we're going to be able to put across. We've got the former lead designer at Nike, who's wheeled out a load of smash hit sneakers in the past, coming to talk about transforming a sneaker design into a marketing icon. One that I'm really excited about, David.
Go on.
Should we break this news? But we've just got...
Go on.
We just got the chief executive of Mitchell & Ness, the retro sportswear company, Eli Kumekpor. He's going to come on to the program and talk about nostalgia marketing, basically, and how to roll out products in a limited, restricted way to fit bang on a kind of cultural moment, which I think is going to be fascinating. Also...
Go on.
The Princess Di jacket. We were talking to Mitchell & Ness about this.
Yes, we were.
About this session. And in the course of the conversation, the Princess Di jacket came up. I hadn't realised.
Well, mentioned it.
Our dearly departed Princess of Wales, Diana herself, wore this jacket once. It's a beautiful green Philadelphia Eagles jacket, and I think it was early 90s, late 80s, I'm not sure when it was, but the kind of fashion cultural impact that had was extraordinary, apparently. I hadn't realised, passed me by, David.
No.
As a child.
Just as you were talking there, I could really...
Switched off.
No, I could really see you on a royal podcast of some sort, and perhaps that's, you know, something to think about. Kenny and Ann Jonathan will be with us in New York as well, and I think this will be really interesting. So he, as many of you will know, is the creative director at Crystal Palace. Big fanfare when he was appointed to that role last year, the first of this creative director in the Premier League for a Premier League team. And this is a role that we are seeing pop up increasingly, particularly in the United States. I think we're going to see more of it among other Premier League teams over the next few years. Really concerned with, of course, fashion and bringing, I suppose, more lifestyle wear to the market ultimately. But I think his perspective coming from the UK is going to be really interesting in sort of adding to this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Elsewhere, we've got NASCAR. We've got a NASCAR driver coming along. We've got Connor Schell, former ESPN producer who was instrumental in the Netflix tennis stuff, now at Words and Pictures, his own production agency. They did the NASCAR documentary.
Yes. Doing a little bit of research on Connor.
Oh, yeah.
And he was also an executive producer on OJ Made in America.
I did know that, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. Because I've also done my research on him in the past.
Very good.
We've got Universal Music there, of course. We have got Reddit. Post-IPO, pre-IPO, I'm not sure, but we will see. We've got the NHL. We'll likely have Major League Baseball.
We've got Rob McElhenney's Chief Strategy Officer, Kelsey Traynor, okay. Who will be excellent. So you might have seen over the past few weeks, Rob McElhenney has sort of grouped together his various and growing business interests, sports interests, of course, Wrexham. He also has a whiskey brand.
They've all got whiskey brands.
Yeah, he's also a new minority investor amongst several other people in the Alpine F1 team. But he's grouped...
Jimmy Worrell, also a minority investor in the Alpine F1 team.
I believe that is the case, yes, yes. Kelsey Traynor works for More Better, which is the new umbrella group for Rob McElhenney's various business interests. Really interesting session that we're building out with her at the centre around how you develop lifestyle brands around talent and the opportunities that opens up, and perhaps some of the challenges that creates as well. But I think that'll be a really super session. It is all shaping up very nicely indeed. A reminder of those dates, May the 21st, May the 22nd. You're going to be there.
I should be there, yeah.
Oh, should?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'll be there, and we expect you there too. Have a look at the website if you would like more details on how to get there. But we're very much looking forward to that.
Do you know who won't be there? That is the tennis players who are taking part in the French Open.
Yes, it's a big clash with Roland Garros, isn't it?
There's unfortunately a clash with Roland Garros. It's actually genuinely... The New York event is a fabulous event for talent and brands. Mm. Like, if last year is anything to go on, the amount of senior decision-making brand marketing executives that we had in the room was many. And we had some amazing talent. Like, this question of how do athletes, entertainment stars build businesses around them and make an impact and then do well off that impact for themselves and for others is absolutely central. So it's going to be great. The reason I bring up tennis, they won't be there. They'll be playing tennis in Paris.
It's all going off, isn't it?
What the heck is going on in tennis, David?
Right.
You spoke to Ahmad Nasser a couple of weeks ago. You know my thoughts on unions doing business. Those thoughts have changed slightly since I listened to Ahmed Nasser.
Okay.
What's going on in tennis? We're gonna rip up the rule book in tennis.
Well,
tram lines are in all of a sudden.
Not necessarily ripping up the rule book, but potentially smashing down the structure of tennis and rebuilding it. There's multiple ongoing conversations and proposals about the future of tennis, which is all being brought to the table and brought to public attention by the opportunity, the threat, the promise, however you want to look at it, of big Saudi money. And I think this is another example, and we have seen it in several sports, but the latest example of Saudi money, or the prospect of Saudi money, opening up conversations amongst stakeholders in individual sports that they maybe felt that they should be having, but didn't see any point in having because they lacked the means or lacked the opportunity to make major fundamental structural changes to their sport. And I think
so one of the major ones in tennis is obviously, why have we got two individual tours going on, the ATP for the men, the WTA for the women? There is some crossover between them, but very little.
Yeah, and there's been in the past few years, there has been a bit more flirting, I would say, between them, but still no sign of a genuine
full marriage.
Merger/marriage until potentially $1 billion was put on the table by the Saudi Public Investment Fund. And that is one vision of two that tennis stakeholders are currently examining and looking at. So you have vision one, a merger between the ATP and WTA tours, effectively bankrolled by Saudi money.
So this would be new tennis co, men and women compete together on the same circuit and play the Grand Slams in the same spots as the Grand Slams are played. The Grand Slams are separate.
Correct.
To this new tour.
And what this proposal would also include, because the Saudis are putting up a lot of money here, and it's worth saying that the Public Investment Fund, actually as a public-facing brand, is now being seen at a lot of ATP tournaments as part of a major new deal that they've struck, which is around sponsorship and strategy rather than putting an event anywhere. But this proposal would see a 1,000 level, you know, the top tier of ATP events held in Riyadh. And the suggestion was that that could be a new season opener in January, which caught the attention of Craig Tiley, the supremo at the Australian Open, which, of course, kicks off the tennis season, not just the tournament itself, but the whole summer of tennis, as they call it, in Australia that lead up to the tournament, multiple events in different cities, the United Cup mixed team event. Craig Tiley, obviously very unhappy at the prospect of that all being jumbled up in favour of a new big money tournament in Riyadh to kick off the season. He has therefore proposed Vision 2 for tennis's future, which is a premier tour, an elevated tour that would include the four Grand Slam tournaments. They would be brought into the fold alongside 10 1,000 level equivalent events in various cities around the world, mixed events, men's and women's tournaments happening at the same time in much the same way as we're seeing at several, but not all, tournaments on the current ATP and WTA calendar. And this proposal would effectively create a new entity, the Premier Tour, and effectively relegate, downgrade, perhaps even finish off the ATP and WTA as organisations, and would of course leave a gaping hole underneath the elite players, which is currently filled at the moment on the ATP and WTA calendars by weekly smaller events in all sorts of places around the world. So two competing visions for tennis's future. No clarity as yet on which one will be taken up. It is worth saying that as it stands, the Craig Tiley vision for this Premier Tour does not have Saudi money connected to it. The suggestion is, and Lou Scher, the CEO of the US Tennis Association, has sort of taken over from Tiley as the front man for this, and has certainly been quoted. And there was a an in-depth interview that he did with Sports Illustrated last week where he talked about the plans in depth. And he said that at the moment, they're not looking for outside investment. They believe that tennis, fundamentally, the way it's structured at the moment, is commercially underperforming. And there is an opportunity without external investment to raise the level by structuring the tour, structuring the calendar in this new way, and bringing the Grand Slams, the moneymakers, in many respects, into one entity alongside these top-tier tournaments. Lucia was saying that some research that the seven key stakeholder groups, which tennis established it had, yeah, back in 2021, the Boston Consulting Group did a huge amount of research. Tennis came out as the fourth most popular sport in the world, but 70% of tennis fans only watch four events a year, which are the Grand Slams. So fundamentally, that's the problem that, yep, tennis is trying to solve. Final point, it's also a battle of the consultants here. Boston Consulting Group did the sort of initial research. The ATP and WTA tour have hired McKinsey to provide some consultation on this Saudi offer and, yep, this prospect of a new structure that would see the merging of the men's and women's tours. So there's a lot of people involved. The consultants are involved and getting paid very handsomely, I'm sure. All eyes.
Seven key stakeholders.
Well, can you name? I'm trying to name them.
Each group. Well, you've got,
yeah, so the four Grand Slams, four the ATP, the WTA, and the International Tennis Federation as the global governing body, yeah, which of course runs the Billie Jean
Maybe
King
you'd
Cup
add the eighth
and the Davis
in there,
Cup,
the Professional Tennis Players Association, potentially.
Well, perhaps you would. Perhaps you would.
Do you know what? It's tennis. I always think tennis is such an interesting and unique example, I think, in that it's obviously got this very confusing stakeholder environment. It's got this sort of system that mirrors golf ever so slightly, with the majors and then the tours underneath. Mm-hmm. But it's got this amazing ability for its Grand Slams, and its top players are genuinely internationally renowned, like I don't think anything else is. I was listening to a podcast the other day, an American business podcast called The Town. You mm-hmm. might,
yes.
And it's sort of media focused. And I spat out my tea, David, when the host, they were talking about sport on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And the host had not the faintest idea who Jose Mourinho was. There's a new documentary being built around Jose Mourinho. And compared what Netflix was planning to do around Jose Mourinho to what it plans to do around Carlos Alcaraz. Had no problem pronouncing Carlos Alcaraz's name. Knew everything about Carlos Alcaraz. Not a sausage about Jose Mourinho. And I think that's really telling. Sometimes we in the UK, I think, can get a bit blinded by the power of football. Mm-hmm. Jose Mourinho, I would say, huge star, known across the world, not in America, it seems. Carlos Alcaraz, known in America and across the world. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there's such a lot to work through with these these two visions, and of course only one, if any, will come to pass. And it could be that the status quo just remains and all tennis's problems remain. Underneath those Grand Slams, and not many people comparatively are watching them, but there's a phenomenal range of venues and cities that tennis visits each year for top-tier tournaments. If you look at the facilities at Indian Wells, the Larry Ellison tournament, they're in Miami at the moment, playing in the Hard Rock Stadium, where the Miami Dolphins play. There's Monte Carlo coming up, Madrid in a few weeks, which will be a key moment.
Which is where this is going to come out in the wash in Madrid. I wonder why Madrid. Jan Tyriac controls the tournament in a sort of Romanian Spanish renegade. I wonder whether he's why it's happening on his patch. Intriguing. Anyway, let's draw a line under this, David. Have you got any recommendations for the week?
Do you know what? I'm not sure I do. And I think you have. You go on and I'll see if I can rustle something up.
So in the same sort of spirit as Sneakonomics, I have listened to the full series of something called Torn, which is a BBC Radio 4 show turned into a podcast presented by Gus Casely Hayford, who is a...
What a terrific name.
Yeah, a former director of various museums. But this series, the blurb says that it unpicks the hidden histories of what we wear. And they're fascinating little vignettes, sort of 10-minute episodes-ish, explaining the stories of some of the sort of household bits of household name brands or items of clothing that we wear, including things like Nike Air Jordans. I think we know how they came into being, but mm-hmm. Maybe a wider audience doesn't. Ray-Bans, aviator sunglasses, fisherman sweaters. There's all sorts in there, and the Ray-Bans is a particularly interesting story. So the genesis of Ray-Bans, they were invented in between the First and Second World Wars as the US Air Force was breaking records with getting planes to higher and higher altitudes, developing warplanes, and they weren't fit for the altitude. The pilots were not dressed for the altitude in these open cockpit planes. So they needed more and more kind of heavy duty, warm clothing. Also, so they broke a record at one point, went up to 21,000 feet or something like that. And the pilot passed out and the plane dropped down to near the ground. Pilot came to, rescued himself. Hero was found on the floor by a support crew. And his eyeballs had frozen because he'd been up to such a height without any kind of protection. So the bloke who found the pilot and noticed that his eyeballs were frozen was the guy who invented Ray-Bans. Like, that guy needs some glasses to make sure his eyeballs don't freeze again.
Wow.
And now it's a billion-dollar brand. So
Well, sounds absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I will raise your Radio 4 documentary series with a Radio 4 documentary series of my own.
Okay.
which is a half recommendation because I'm making my way through it.
You're not
and
sure.
It's called the... Well, no, I am sure. I'm enjoying it. It's just time, isn't it? Time to listen to all this stuff. It's called The Artificial Human, and it's exactly in my sweet spot of, I'm keen to understand a little bit more about AI and what it could be and what it ought not to be. But I really struggle with the sort of hefty scientific approaches or pieces or features. This is exactly...
You hate the experts, don't you?
No, not at all. I like experts who can convey information in a really breezy, entertaining way. This does, and let me give you a flavour of what some of the episodes are called to give you a sense of it. Should I let my kids use AI for their homework? Could AI swing an election? Is AI better than my doctor? Could AI win an Oscar? How do I avoid being scammed by AI, and should AI make my decisions?
They're all yes-no questions.
Well, they're all 28 or 29-minute episodes. But yes, good listen so far. And Yes, I would recommend it. Radio 4 documentary called The Artificial Human.
There you go. Two rock-solid recommendations to bring the episode to a close. If you are listening on iTunes, please do give us a rating and a review. Give us a... I don't know, is it stars? Do you click?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Great. Five.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Five stars and three sentences, please.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. See you next week.
Goodbye.